going on right now around the ERA. 2026 is the 250th anniversary of the U.S. Constitution, which is the government is planning to mark with major events. What would it mean if the ERA were the law of the land and in the Constitution?
Well, imagine a world or a country in which women and men were paid equally for the work that they're done, that they do. Imagine a country in which LGBTQ plus individuals were actually protected against discrimination because of who they are. And, you know, imagine a world where we can all be sure that we have equality and that our rights will not be infringed upon because someone thinks that we're different. And that's the foundation and the principle, really, that Linda was talking about, that the Equal Rights Amendment provides. And we see overwhelming support in this country for the Equal Rights Amendment. About 78% of the country thinks that we should have an Equal Rights Amendment in our Constitution and that men and women should be treated equally under the law. It's unfortunate that about 73% think that we already have an ERA in our Constitution, but that's why this is so important. It's so imperative for us to get the word out about the Equal Rights Amendment, about this moment in history, that we have the opportunity to change the future for this country and all of our people.
Zakiya Thomas, want to thank you for being with us, President and CEO of the ERA Coalition, and Linda Koberle, Chair of the Legal Task Force at the ERA Coalition. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
You're tuned to listener-supported community radio KBOO, Portland, Oregon, in the beautiful Willamette Valley.
Hello, my name is Jeff, and I am the host of the KBOO show, A Matter of Public Records. Mark E. Smith, singer and driving force of the band The Fall, was born on March 5, 1957, and I have put together a special show to celebrate. It will feature music by The Fall, some spoken word pieces by Mark E. Smith, music that influenced The Fall, and bands that were inspired by The Fall. You can hear the show on March 6th, starting at midnight, exclusively on KBOO, as part of our All Thrills, No Frills winter membership drive. Please consider making a donation today. Thank you.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, a city commissioner deals with fallout from his decision not to issue supplies to houseless people in our area during the recent snowstorm. Oregon lawmakers are considering a bill to address chronic understaffing in our hospitals. And in national news, states move forward with bills aimed at further restricting abortion. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, February 27th, 2023. I'm Michelle Coppola. Well, it's been 5 days since a surprise winter storm hit the Portland metro area, stranding drivers and dropping record inches of snowfall. A rain-snow mix is in the forecast for Tuesday, but it isn't likely to compare to last Wednesday's snow. It was nearly 11 inches. That's the second highest 24-hour snow total ever measured at the Portland airport. Many people have wondered why Portlanders were taken so off guard by the record snowfall. Meteorologists say they expected less snow, with the storm front just passing through and about 3 inches to drop. Instead, the storm front stalled over the region with much more snow than anticipated. Many people were at work by the time the severity of the snowstorm became clear, jamming up roadways. That included the Portland Bureau of Transportation, whose snowplows were caught in the same traffic. Warming shelters opened across the region as well in Multnomah, Clackamas, and Washington counties. On Friday, 850 people sought out warming shelters in Multnomah County. That was also the first time that the Lloyd Center Mall has been used as a warming shelter. Folks slept in what used to be Marshall's. Multnomah County says they will be keeping a close eye on the weather forecast this week, since there is a possibility of snow in the forecast. At least one person died of hypothermia during the snowstorm last week after Portland Street Response brought them to a hospital. In other news related to the weather, it was just last week that Portland City Commissioner Rene Gonzalez banned Portland Street Response and the Fire Bureau from distributing tents and tarps to unhoused Portlanders. It was just days before the record-setting snowstorm hit the Portland area. Gonzalez rationalized the ban as a way to prevent fires, but he did acknowledge the risk that cold posed. He told Willamette Week, quote, "Hypothermia is a risk, as is frostbite. But when talking about frostbite, you're losing fingers. These burns, they're life-changing, even if they don't kill you," end quote. Advocates have pushed back, questioning Gonzalez's data and explanation for the ban. They've called it cruel and inhumane, especially during the coldest and rainiest months of the year. In 2020 and 2021, 11 homeless people died of hypothermia in Multnomah County. In other news, hospital workers have felt the strain of understaffing for years, and the pandemic made conditions even more severe. Oregon lawmakers are considering a bill now that could help reduce their stress through staffing ratios. Eric Tegedoff reports from Salem.
Hospital staff members are struggling under the strain of patient overload, and they want Oregon lawmakers to do something about it. A measure in Salem would create nurse-to-patient ratios so they and other medical staff have a fixed number of patients they are caring for. Aaron Green is a certified nursing assistant at Mackenzie Willamette Medical Center. He says he's had more than 35 patients to tend to at one time, creating potential safety issues.
It's important to me that everyone gets the best care, and the way to do that is to get the staffing ratio so that our loved ones, your loved ones, you, whoever comes in here, knows they're going to get the best care possible.
Oregon hospitals have voiced their opposition to the legislation. The Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems calls it a one-sized solution for a more complex problem. The measure, House Bill 2697, is scheduled for a public hearing on Tuesday. Green says understaffing is straining workers in every part of the hospital, noting that when there aren't enough housekeeping workers, that can make it hard to get patients into beds.
We really need to represent all the staff in the hospital because we're all part of providing best patient care and outcomes.
Green adds staffing issues were an issue before the pandemic, but they have gotten worse since. He says long, stressful hours have burned out many workers, driving some of them out of the profession. For Oregon News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
The Secretary of State lobbies for Ukraine ahead of the G20 summit. The federal government pauses transportation of toxic waste from East Palestine. And President Biden's student loan relief program faces critical Supreme Court challenges. With more on those stories, it's Alex Gonzalez with 2023 Talks.
Welcome to 2023 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
If we do not defend these basic principles, we invite a world in which might makes right, the strong dominate the weak. That's the world this body was created to end.
Secretary of State Antony Blinken addressed the United Nations Security Council on the anniversary of the Ukraine invasion, stressing that Russia's war can't set the new normal. Blinken heads to Kazakhstan and Uzbekistan this week before going to India for the G20 summit, where he will meet with Russian and Chinese leaders. During an interview with CBS's Face the Nation, CIA Director William Burns says the U.S. still hopes to deter Beijing from making a risky bet by sending lethal military aid to Russia.
Well, we're confident that the Chinese leadership is considering the provision of lethal equipment. We also don't see that a final decision has been made yet.
The federal government ordered a temporary halt on shipment of contaminated waste from the train derailment in East Palestine Saturday. States getting the waste, Michigan and Texas, asked the EPA for the pause. Secretary of Transportation Pete Buttigieg says their main focus is still folks in the Ohio town.
Our focus is on making sure that residents in this community are taken care of and making sure that trains get safer in this country.
President Joe Biden's plan for student loan relief reaches a critical moment Tuesday. Oral arguments before a conservative-leaning Supreme Court. It faces legal challenges from Republican-led states and from two student loan borrowers who've already paid their debts. But Biden says millions of other students deserve to get up to $20,000 in relief.
And about 90% of that relief is going to go to people making less than $75,000 a year. Let me be clear. Not a dime will go to those in the top 5% of the income.
Over the weekend, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis hosted donors in Palm Beach, not far from former President Donald Trump's Mar-a-Lago estate. Several of those in attendance have been major Trump backers, but DeSantis sounds like a candidate.
Florida is leading the nation. We are number one in these United States in net in-migration. We are the nation's fastest growing state.
DeSantis hasn't officially announced a presidential bid yet, but Democrats there are already taking aim. They elected former Florida Agriculture Commissioner Nikki Fried to be their state chair after a weak election in what had been a blue year in other places. Fried says she will work to unite Democrats in Florida and deny the presidency to DeSantis should he run.
Breaking huge glass ceilings as your first elected female commissioner and tackling some of the greatest challenges of our time.
I'm Alex Gonzalez for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our A-Trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
Rail transport company Norfolk Southern is accused of trying to destroy evidence of its wreck in East Palestine, Ohio. Lawyers for class action plaintiffs asked a federal judge to block the train company from removing and destroying the train cars that derailed. Norfolk Southern planned to move the 11 rail cars by March 1st and only allow them to be inspected for 2 days. The sides have now agreed to add an extra day for residents' lawyers to inspect those train cars. The derailed train cars released toxic chemicals, and officials decided to do a controlled burn of other chemicals in hopes they wouldn't explode. Residents have said that the smoke from that controlled burning has resulted in headaches, lingering smells, and the death of a number of pets. On Sunday, federal officials gave Norfolk Southern the okay to resume shipping hazardous waste from the East Palestine site. Lawyers for the residents who were impacted and the railroad company are still negotiating the procedure for taking soil samples at the derailment site. A rash of gun violence in the U.S. hasn't escaped the notice of Washington state legislators. The Gun Violence Archive has counted 80 mass shootings so far in 2023. Lawmakers in Olympia want to ban semi-automatic rifles to decrease mass shootings. The high-powered weapons have been responsible for some of the deadliest shootings in modern U.S. history. Eric Tegedoff has the details.
Amidst growing concern about mass shootings, Washington state lawmakers are considering a measure that would restrict high-powered guns. House Bill 1240 aims to prohibit the sale, manufacture, and distribution of semi-automatic rifles, known as assault weapons. April Shintrup's daughter Carmen was killed when a gunman with an AR-15 rifle stormed her Parkland, Florida high school.
Because he chose that weapon, he was able to go through all three floors of the building, shooting students and teachers as he saw them in the hallway, but also through doors of the classroom.
Shintrup now lives in Washington State and advocates for gun safety measures. Opponents of the bill say it erodes their constitutional gun rights. HB 1240 is waiting for a vote on the House floor. It has until March 8th to pass out of the chamber. Dylan O'Connor with the Alliance for Gun Responsibility says states that have prohibited semi-automatic weapons have seen fewer mass shooting events, and if they do happen, fewer casualties. He says these weapons have no role in public life.
They happen to be the favorite tool of the mass shooter, and providing as much of a barrier to entry on access to such dangerous firearms is great for public health.
O'Connor says other gun legislation is in play this session as well, including a bill requiring a permit to purchase or transfer a firearm and a bill that would create liability for the gun industry. Shintrup says the prohibition on semi-automatic rifles is necessary.
I truly believe that this bill, if it's passed in the state of Washington, will help save lives.
Other states, including California, Hawaii, and New York, have enacted similar bans on high-powered rifles. The gun lobby has opposed this measure. For Washington News Service, I'm Eric Tegedov.
In international news, Israel sent hundreds of troops to the West Bank today, one day after Israeli settlers went on a rampage through a Palestinian town. The settlers burned homes and vehicles in what has been called the worst such violence in decades. The response from Israel's new right-wing government was mixed. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu appealed for calm, while at least one member of his ruling coalition praised the rampage as deterrence against Palestinian attacks. The U.S. has been trying to bring Israeli and Palestinian officials together to work out a plan for de-escalation. On Sunday, a Palestinian gunman shot and killed two brothers in a shooting ambush in the Palestinian town of Hawera, located in the northern West Bank. Following the shooting, groups of Israeli settlers rampaged along the main thoroughfare in Hawera. A video showed a crowd of settlers standing in prayer as they watched a building burn. This morning, a city thoroughfare was lined with rows of burned-out cars and blackened buildings. Palestinian media said about 30 homes and cars were torched. Israeli Defense Minister Yoav Gallant told reporters that Israel, quote, cannot allow a situation in which citizens take the law into their own hands, end quote. But Gallant did not specifically condemn that violence. The Israeli army deployed hundreds of additional troops to the area with the aim of de-escalation. Sunday's violence drew condemnation from the international community. The U.S. State Department called for an immediate de-escalation in tensions in words and deeds. The international community considers the Israeli settlements in East Jerusalem and the West Bank illegal. So far this year, 62 Palestinians have been killed by Israelis. In the same period, 14 Israelis have been killed in Palestinian attacks. Listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Coast Range Radio. Then at 6 o'clock, it's Labor Radio. At 6:30, Prison Pipeline. And at 7, Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be a rain and snow mix with an overnight low of 34. Definitely some snow accumulation in the higher elevations. Tomorrow's weather, rainy with a high of 42. Today in history, it was in 1934 that American political activist Ralph Nader was born. He first became known for his book Unsafe at Any Speed, which critiqued the safety records of American car makers. He also ran for president four times as a Green Party candidate, a Reform Party candidate, and once as an independent. The quote of the day is from Nader, who said, "A society that has more justice is a society that needs less charity." More remains of First Nations children may have been found at a former residential school on Vancouver Island in British Columbia. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. A First Nation in British Columbia says it's found what are believed to be children's remains at a suspected gravesite of a former residential school. As Dan Karpinchuk reports, the discovery comes after an 18-month effort to find potential graves.
The Vancouver Island First Nation says it's found 17 suspected unmarked graves at the site of the former Alberni Indian Residential School. The work included interviews with survivors, historical records, and other documents. Although 17 suspected graves were found, records show that 67 students died at the school. Children from as many as 70 First Nations attended the Alberni Residential School during its operation from 1900 to 1973. Ground-penetrating radar was also used to look for possible graves at the site. In addition, Sherry Meeting, the lead researcher, says survivors told searchers where to look, and they knew multiple locations.
Many spoke about forced abortions, multiple different burial locations without grave markers, finding skulls and human skeletal remains in and around the residence grounds as students.
Meeting says many of the children died from medical conditions. Band officials say any investigations would be conducted independently with the consent of the Shoshat First Nation. The elected chief counselor also wants the Canadian government to review the Royal Canadian Mounted Police role at the school. From 1942 to 1952, children at the Alberni School were subjected to nutrition experiments without the consent of their parents. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
The Central American country of Guatemala recently commemorated its National Day to remember victims of the country's armed conflict, a bloody civil war that lasted 36 years and killed more than 200,000 people, the majority of them indigenous. On that day, victims' groups filed legal action to stop the daughter of a former dictator convicted of genocide from running for president. Maria Martin reports.
They stood in front of Guatemala's Supreme Court. Hundreds of indigenous protesters carrying crosses, bearing the names of dead family members, as they filed a suit to keep conservative pro-military candidate Sully Rios off the presidential ballot. The attorney for the victims, Juan Marcos, says Guatemala's constitution prohibits the candidacies of family members of those who promoted military coups. In 1982, Sully Rios' father, General Efraín Rios Montt, gained power in a military overthrow. Hundreds of massacres took place during his rule. In 1993, he was convicted of genocide of the Ishil Maya, though the ruling was later overturned on a technicality. Meanwhile, Rios maintains she has every right to run, and she's a leading candidate for the June 25th election. I'm Maria Martin.
A part of Alaska history has passed, along with Elizabeth Kudrin, who was remembered at a memorial service in Anchorage on Saturday as a great survivor. Few Alaskans know her story, and even fewer Americans. Kudrin was one of two remaining survivors from Attu, a remote Aleutian island captured by Japanese soldiers during World War II. Elizabeth was just a baby when she and the rest of her village were taken to Japan as prisoners of war. About half of them died during captivity. Her husband, George, says her death marks the end of an era.
She's probably the matriarch of matriarchs, the last mom from Attu.
Kudrin says his wife never talked about the war. It was too difficult. She died just a few days after her 82nd birthday on February 19th. Her brother is now the last remaining survivor of Attu. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
States across the U.S. continue to move to further restrict abortion care, and West Virginia is no different. Governor Jim Justice signed a bill into law last year effectively banning most abortions in West Virginia and barring providers from using telemedicine for abortion care, which includes prescribing mifepristone. West Virginia's Attorney General Patrick Morrissey recently filed a motion to dismiss a lawsuit against the state by GenBioPro, a pharmaceutical company that makes a generic version of that medication. Nadia Ramlagan has the story.
It's the latest chapter in West Virginia's attempt to outlaw abortion. West Virginia Attorney General Patrick Morrissey is attempting to throw out a lawsuit against the state by GenBioPro, a pharmaceutical company that makes a generic version of the medication abortion mifepristone, according to documents filed last week. GenBioPro's lawsuit argues that West Virginia's current abortion law violates several federal laws, including banning a drug approved by the FDA. Rachel Fay, with the group Power to Decide, says she hopes it doesn't signal a troubling trend post Roe v. Wade.
Tylenol is not legal or illegal depending on what state you're in, and we shouldn't be entering into an era where individual states get to decide what drugs are safe and effective.
House Bill 305, signed into law by Governor Jim Justice last year, effectively bans most abortions and bars providers from using telemedicine for abortion care. The state of West Virginia argues that while the drug is regulated by the FDA, drug makers can't tell states to expand access to the abortion pill. The FDA approved mifepristone more than 20 years ago. Fay points out that mifepristone is a critical component of abortion care, especially for people in rural regions unable to take time off work or who lack reliable transportation to another state.
54% of all abortions in this country are medication abortions. It allows people to have abortions early in pregnancy safely.
Women are now traveling on average three times farther to receive abortions, in some cases hundreds of miles, according to research published last year in the Journal of the American Medical Association. This is Nadia Ramlagan for West Virginia News Service.
The U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration, or DEA, will put up telehealth guardrails for drugs such as Adderall that have a high risk of abuse. That is according to a new announcement from them on Friday. Nearly 4 million people reported misusing prescription stimulants in 2021. That's according to data from the National Institutes of Health. Nadia Ramlagan has more.
The federal government says it's clamping down on the use of telehealth for drugs that have a high risk of abuse. Under the proposed rules, doctors will be required to see patients in person for a prescription at least once for drugs such as Adderall and Ritalin. Nearly 4 million people reported misusing prescription stimulants in 2021, according to data from the National Institutes of Health. Michelle Lindenberg with the Cincinnati-based Interact for Health says both prescription and non-prescription drug use have had devastating effects on Ohio communities.
So we're talking about HIV, hepatitis C. Those are extremely costly, unfortunate diseases to have to deal with. There are many ripple effects that go along with a increased rate of substance use disorder, overdose, and overdose death in a community.
In a news release, U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration Administrator Ann Milgram says the agency is committed to the expansion of telemedicine with guardrails that prevent the online overprescribing of controlled medications that can cause harm. The new rules will likely go into effect this spring. Lindenberg says counties could begin thinking about how to improve access to substance use resources in rural counties, especially as opioid settlement money flows in.
The stigma of addiction makes it harder to expand and access those services.
In Ohio, more than 5,200 people died of a drug overdose in 2020, according to the CDC. According to a new Axios Ipsos poll, around 1 in 4 Americans say opioids and fentanyl are the nation's top public health threat. This story was produced in association with Media in the Public Interest and funded in part by the George Gund Foundation. This is Nadia Ramlagan for Ohio News Connection.
The National Food Waste Warriors Program from the World Wildlife Fund will help students learn how to address food waste, the climate crisis, and food insecurity all at the same time. The goal is to inspire local K-12 students to lead in developing a more circular food system. Trimble Gomes has more on that story in Florida.
Students in the Orlando area could soon get more classroom time during their lunchtime to learn more about ways to fight hunger and food waste. It's estimated that 40% of the food produced globally is lost or wasted. The Food Waste Warriors program of the World Wildlife Fund inspires kids to help alleviate local and global food insecurity. It prompts them to think through practical solutions that can be easy to implement, like a share table, where food you're not going to eat can be shared with someone else. Alex Nichols Venuesa with the World Wildlife Fund says the idea is to empower students to have a role in addressing issues in their community.
Around, you know, food insecurity, around the environmental impacts of the food system. And so it's a way that it's not controversial that you can really engage students on some of these issues.
He says they're just starting in Orlando, making connections with school districts and community partners, and their goal is to work with 5 to 7 schools in the year ahead. In addition to providing free educational materials, there will also be grant opportunities to get programs and ideas off the ground. Nichols Venuesa says reducing food waste is increasingly being recognized as an effective solution to reducing greenhouse gas emissions. He adds it isn't political like so many facets of the climate change debate. And one practical way to help students understand is through show and tell.
You know, engaging in an interactive way, get into their cafeterias and look at what's being thrown away. You know, what are those foods that are most being discarded and why? And it's a very visceral understanding of the issue, right?
The program is calling on schools across the country to use their cafeterias as classrooms through activities like conducting food waste audits and learning more about the connections between their food, wildlife, and habitat conservation. This is Trimmel Gomes for Florida News Connection. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Monday, February 27th, 2023. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Josh Salem. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Alex Gonzalez, to Eric Tegatoff, Nadia Ramlagan, and Antonia Gonzalez. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM. K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Michelle Coppola. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members, great people like you. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for Coast Range Radio, and have a great night.
Prison Pipeline is a radio program dedicated to educating the public about the Oregon criminal justice system. Topics include incarceration and reentry, addictions and mental health, elections and laws, victims' rights, and criminal justice reform. The program presents a unique understanding of the criminal justice system, addresses the root causes of crime, and challenges the status quo. It seeks to promote awareness and activism in order to foster a safer, healthier, and more just society.
Prison Pipeline airs on Monday evenings from 6:30 to 7 p.m. on KBOO Portland. Check us out every week. If you miss an episode, you can stream it later. Just go to kboo.fm/prisonpipeline. More info about upcoming shows and events related to the prison community can be found on our Facebook page, Prison Pipeline.